Hi, David.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Great. How are you?
I can't complain. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. And this is The Wright Show. You are David Yellen, Dean of Loyola Law School in Chicago, also an old friend. And you are involved in a bizarre and kind of horrifying case of police misconduct in Chicago. You didn't do any of the misconduct. It dates back decades, but its consequences live on, and it's the consequences that you're dealing with in a kind of quasi-official capacity. We're going to talk about that. It's relevant to a number of things in the news, I would say. Ferguson, the I Can't Breathe case, the question of how police misconduct should be investigated, the question of the police and race relations, and so on. It's also related to a story that just happened to pop up in between the time you and I decided to do this and now, which was a big piece in The Guardian by Spencer Ackerman on a so-called black site in Chicago, the same city you're in, and involving the same police force that your investigation is involved with. The headline was "The Disappeared: Chicago Police Detain Americans at Abuse-Laden Black Site." Now, first, let me say that your case is actually what that sounds like, right? I mean, we'll get into that in a few minutes, but the case you're looking at that happened some time ago in Chicago is as dark as it gets. But why don't we talk a little about this piece? It made such a splash. It had like 95,000 Facebook shares. Did you read the piece?
I did. I'd never heard about it before. It's a place called Homan Square, which is a location in Chicago where there is a police facility. It's a sort of technical site. You know, there's a lot of computer and other operations going on there. And the allegation in the story is that it's used as, in essence, a black site where suspects are disappeared for some amount of time, 12, 18 hours.
Yeah, it wasn't like super long amounts of time.
No.
It was kind of like before being, I guess, officially booked and sometimes before being allowed to call a lawyer.
Right. Whoops, there's a glitch. My light just went off.
It actually looks better, I got to say.
Okay.
I think a cinematographer would probably do it this way.
Yeah, these are environmentally sensitive lights that choose to go on and off when they want.
As they will. Well, yeah, I welcome our robot overlords. So I mean, the piece, I thought when I read it, it was a little bit less than met the eye with the headline. It was a little less dramatic than the headline. It was also quite dependent on the accounts by defense attorneys and, you know, so I wasn't sure what to make of it. I guess there was one allegation. Well, there was one case they said where somebody actually died there. And there was kind of one allegation of somebody suffering physical abuse.
And I saw an interview on TV with one of the men who was discussed in the story, and he claimed that he'd been held for 18 or so hours, that he was handcuffed to a bench and, you know, was interrogated without having his rights read, wasn't allowed to contact an attorney, all that classic kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I also spoke to a couple of defense lawyers here in town who are sensitive to this kind of allegation, and they were anywhere from, yeah, I've heard that kind of stuff, but I don't really have much direct knowledge, to other variations. So it seems a little murky to me whether this is a real story or whether there were a couple of isolated instances of misconduct there.
I mean, a lot of it sounded to me like the kind of thing that sadly probably goes on periodically in police stations, and you don't really need to set up a black site, right? It's like, You hold the guy for 12 hours and put him under pressure and refuse to call a lawyer. I fear that happens more, you know, more pervasively than we may realize. But it's not like you'd have to have a whole building for it.
And especially nowadays in places like Chicago, there are formal rules that someone taken into custody must be entered into a computer system within like an hour. Mm-hmm. And so it would take, you know, intentional violation of that policy to keep someone off the books for in this manner.
Well, it could be then that having a separate facility actually facilitates the violation of the rule in some way. Maybe that was the deal.
If you were setting out to violate those rules, yeah, you would probably want to do it somewhere where you wouldn't be seen. But I just don't have a sense at this point about whether this case, unlike the one we're going to talk about, mm-hmm. which is absolutely real, whether there's a big story there.
Okay. And now let's get to your case. You've been appointed by the court as a what? It's called a special master?
Yes.
Okay. And explain to us what you're going to do and what the case is that you're doing it in relation to.
Sure. This involves a man named John Burge. Burge was on the Chicago police force from the early 70s to the early 90s. He was a detective and a supervisor of detectives. And from early in his tenure, there were allegations that he abused suspects. And eventually it all unraveled and it became clear that he and some of the detectives working with him were systematically torturing, it's not too strong a word, torturing suspects, all or virtually all African-American men on the south and west side of the city.
And by Burge was himself white.
He is white. And
what's an example?
Actually, all the officers.
Sorry, what's an example of the kind of torture they were doing?
Yeah, well, they did some routine roughing up of suspects, hitting them on the head with phone books and stuff like that. But Burge's specialty was electric devices. So he had a box with a hand crank that, when cranked, generated electricity. And electrodes were attached to the genitals and anus and face of suspects, and they were electrocuted. Well, not to death, but they were shocked. Mm-hmm. And they also used a cattle prod and some other kind of wand that was an electric device. All of these things inflicted excruciating pain, didn't leave much of a mark in most cases.
And this was to coerce them into confessing to crimes.
Exactly.
And do we have any idea how many people this kind of thing was done to?
Yeah, the conservative estimate is 75 to 100. That's the amount documented in an official investigation that eventually happened a dozen years after he was fired from the force. Mm-hmm. So it was dozens or hundreds.
Okay. And Burge has been released from prison. He did time, but he's out now, right?
Well, he didn't do time for torturing anyone. Huh. What happened was eventually this unraveled in a high-profile murder case in the 1980s when two police officers were killed. And when Burge and his associates arrested the man who did it, they
who,
beat him.
Who we actually know did it or who they...
Yeah, he was convicted several times of this crime, and he was a bad guy. And yeah, he did it, but they tortured him into confessing, and he practically died from the beating. Eventually, the conviction was overturned because of the abuse. He was then retried without his confession and was convicted again and spent the rest of his life in prison. But because that's the case that led to the unraveling of this, mm-hmm. right? And then Burge was investigated by the police themselves, and he was suspended in 1991 and fired in 1993, but he was never prosecuted. Eventually, a special prosecutor was appointed who looked into it, confirmed in a voluminous report what had happened, but the statute of limitations on the abuse had run. Hmm. A lot of inmates and released people filed civil suits, civil rights actions. And in one of those civil cases, Burge testified, denied any misconduct, and was subsequently prosecuted and convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice. And that's what he spent several years in prison for.
Okay. And he's been released, I think, pretty recently. And he's, I guess, an old guy now, but...
He's late 60s.
So he started young in the torture business, I guess.
He had just come back from Vietnam when he joined the force. And In fact, there's been speculation that that's where he learned the black box technique, because apparently that was something that was done in both Korea and Vietnam. Yeah, he was quite young.
That was something that American troops did to detainees?
That's what I've read in some journalist examinations. Uh-huh.
Okay, so he's out now. Meanwhile, though, you are dealing with the consequences of this in what way in your role as special master?
Yeah, so obviously this happened a long time ago. Burge was fired in 1993. And after that, and especially after the official report of the Burge misconduct, some people had their convictions overturned. Some people won civil actions. But a few years ago, some lawyers in town filed a lawsuit alleging that there are still X number of people in prison since at least 1993, who claimed at the time of their conviction that they'd been tortured into confessing by Burge or his subordinates, and have never had post-conviction review with the assistance of counsel since the official acknowledgement of what Burge did. Mm-hmm. So what I've been asked to do is look for inmates who meet that criteria. And the ones we identify will have a lawyer appointed for them by the chief judge of the criminal court of Cook County, and they will get an opportunity to have a post-conviction review.
Okay. And so it must be hard. I mean, you're trying to find every valid case there is. A lot of cases must come to your attention that for one reason or another don't qualify. And on the other hand, it must be hard to track down every possible valid case there is, right?
Yeah, well, it's a closed universe in one sense that it only involves people currently in prison.
Okay.
So I had notices posted in all of the state's prisons, and I've probably received letters from 500 or 600 inmates. Many of them didn't have a valid claim, but had some other complaint they were hoping to get some help with. In many cases, it's very hard to tell from their letter possibly meet the criteria. So I have several students working with me on this also as volunteers, and we have to pull and examine their court files and do some other legwork to figure out whether they do meet the criteria.
And if they meet the criteria, what will be the next step for them if you say they've met the criteria?
The next step is that the judge will appoint a lawyer to represent them in a post-conviction proceeding where they will see my job. I don't assess the validity of their claim. I assess whether they made a claim properly at the time of their conviction that they were tortured.
I see.
And then it will go now to a judge who will have to determine the validity of that claim. Under a decision by the Illinois Supreme Court, any conviction that was based even in part on a conviction obtained through torture has to be overturned.
Okay.
Then the state could conceivably try that person again if they want to after all these years, but their conviction would be overturned.
And if the defendants did not go on record saying this had happened at the time of their trials, they have no recourse?
Well, they have no recourse through the process that I've been asked to volunteer on.
Uh-huh.
You know, technically speaking, there's nothing stopping them from filing a petition now for post-conviction review, but their claim is going to have so much more weight if at the time
Sure. They
said things that no one could have known had they not been subject to this kind of abuse.
Okay. And you said almost all, were black. Do they know of some non-black people this happened to?
I said most or all to be safe, but I believe they were all African-American. And, you know, Burge was working during this time period in two precincts in Chicago that were in almost all black areas, poor black areas. So, you know, it isn't like he was dealing with a lot of white suspects of serious crimes at the time.
Do you have any idea how widely known this was within the department?
That's a great you know, everyone official denies any knowledge of it. You know, the people who blew the lid on this think that it had to be known higher up in the department and maybe even by some of the prosecutors involved. Interestingly, the state's attorney during most of this time was Richard Daley, who then went on to become mayor of Chicago for many, many years. There's been no official decision that any higher ups tolerated or encouraged it. But it's also pretty clear that after Burge left the force, some of the guys who trained under him went off to other areas of the city and at least for some time continued the same kind of activities.
Okay. And are you aware of reports of things of this magnitude happening in other police forces in the United States over the last half century or so?
You know, obviously in any city in the country, you're going to hear lots of allegations of police abuse. And there are proven instances of police abuse in many places around the country. But this is a pretty unique case in terms of how systematic and how extensive and the number of years and sort of the intensity of it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Now, one question this leads to that is related to, like, Ferguson and the I Can't Breathe case is how we should go about, you know, investigating allegations of police conduct and seeking indictments and so on. Now, you know, it's, I guess, it, in the case of Ferguson, I gather, the, you know, it was like the local prosecutor, more or less, was investigating local police. Now, can you talk a little about how kind of intimate the relationship is between local prosecutors and local police on like a day-to-day basis?
Sure. It's an incredibly close working relationship. You know, all any lay person has to do is watch Law and Order, and you'll see, you know, how much the prosecutors depend on the police to identify suspects, investigate, etc. So it's a very close working relationship, and it creates an inherent tension in, you know, in tasking the regular prosecutors with investigating and potentially prosecuting crimes that may have been committed by police officers. But everywhere in the country, that's the norm, that it's the regular, usually elected district attorney or state's attorney office that is in charge of investigating criminal activity by the police.
And it just seems to me that's a very bad idea. I mean, it's just beyond awkward for a prosecutor to start throwing cops in jail because he's got to work with their colleagues the next day, right?
Yeah, and if anyone who watched, you know, the behavior of Patrick Lynch, the head of the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association in New York, in the recent kerfuffle there, knows, you know, the police are not, they have some ability to engage in political activity and punish people they think are against their interest. Mm-hmm. Now, in many cities nowadays, there are citizen oversight boards, but they generally deal with complaints against the police in terms of potential on-the-job discipline, mm-hmm. not about criminal prosecution. So virtually everywhere in the country, that work is done by the regular prosecutors, unless in a particular case, a special prosecutor is appointed. But yeah, I agree with you. The current system is really a recipe for inaction, and there are alternatives that ought to be considered more carefully.
What do you think is a good example of a kind of doable reform?
Well, let's think about what the options are. You know, if the elected prosecutor has this inherent tension, we could have a special prosecutor's office that was the permanent body that only looked at police misconduct cases. That's plausible, but special prosecutors have their own set of problems. They tend to be very expensive. You know, they spend lots of money on each case, and they kind of have an inherent bias towards indicting. When they only have a very few cases to look at.
Because like their resume, like that's what you want on your resume if you're a special prosecutor. You want just the way a cop wants some arrests.
Exactly. Same incentive structure makes the special prosecutor route problematic. Some have argued that this all ought to be federal, that the U.S. attorneys ought to be the ones investigating and prosecuting the local police. Problem with that is that much of the alleged misconduct by police doesn't violate federal law. It only violates state law. And U.S. attorneys' offices have limited resources to look into that. I just read the other day a really good proposal by a law professor out in Utah that the state attorney generals ought to be the body that investigates allegations against the police. They're public officials, they're responsive to the citizenry, but they're several steps removed from the day-to-day work of the police. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is a real promising alternative, but the police and prosecutors vigorously resist any effort to give that authority to anyone other than the regular prosecutors.
Do you think there'd be not much point in a mere kind of change of venue? In other words, a prosecutor two counties over investigates, or do you think they would be, you know, they would feel really awkward just to have to face their cops the next day after indicting a cop two counties over?
Yeah, just like sometimes for the rights of a defendant, there has to be a change of venue. If that were the choice, you know, if there's an allegation of police misconduct, would it be better handled by a prosecutor from another county? Sure. But the problem is, you know, so in Chicago is Cook County, massive county, massive criminal justice apparatus. None of the surrounding counties are remotely as sophisticated as is Cook County. So it would be pretty difficult for a small county prosecutor to really be effectively investigating activities that took place in Chicago.
Okay.
So it's a tough problem.
So let's talk a little about kind of applied examples. Let's talk a little about Ferguson and the I Can't Breathe case. First of all, I want to ask you, do you have any sense of when you're going to wrap up with your thing?
This spring, we've been at work for close to a year. Mm-hmm. We've made some recommendations to the court about inmates who should get counsel appointed. The first batch just had those appointments made, and there'll be more in the next few
weeks. How many were there?
This first batch was just four, but there's another 15 at this point who are reasonably likely to get lawyers appointed. And there's another, you know, another 100 cases we're still looking at.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, first of all, do you have a take on Ferguson, on I Can't Breathe, just from your point of view? I mean, what kinds of things were you thinking when these things were going on?
Gosh, yeah, it's they're different cases, and it, you know, so different. And the Ferguson case was horrible, but it wasn't really the best exemplar of police misconduct and what is really police mistreatment of African Americans. It was much too complicated and murky a case to be sort of the poster child for a movement that I think is an appropriate movement, and I'm glad it's getting a lot of traction these days, but it's too bad that the facts of the case, such as we know them, you know, got in the way from a needed discussion. So you know, okay.
So part of the problem is just that the facts remain unclear, especially the facts at the point of the actual shooting, the lethal shooting.
Right. The whole hands up movement. Right. You know, I think most people now don't think that Michael Brown had his hands up in peaceful surrender when he was shot, whatever else happened before that. Right. It doesn't mean that the officer didn't do things wrong. Doesn't mean that Mike Brown wouldn't be alive if he were white. But it was a very, very complicated case.
And there is also evidence now consistent with the cop's account that Michael Brown approached him aggressively. In other words, the original altercation seems to have taken place basically inside the car. You know, and there's evidence of that, right?
Yeah. Although back to your other point, you know, the detailed report that the local prosecutor gave, you know, showed that his actions as a prosecutor were very nuanced and balanced. In other words, he presented both sides of the story to the grand jury in a way that prosecutors rarely, if ever,
exactly.
Did.
Like, yeah. I mean, prosecutors generally go in wanting an indictment. I mean, if they call a grand jury, they want an indictment, right?
It would have been very difficult for the officer to be convicted and have a conviction upheld. But it wouldn't have been very difficult to get an indictment of him if that were your goal.
If the cop had wanted an indictment, I mean, if the prosecutor wanted an indictment, he could have taken the existing body of evidence and done what prosecutors normally do when they want an indictment, which is present it selectively, and he could have gotten one.
Yes, exactly.
And so there was something a little suspicious about him saying that, well, anyway, this was the deal. I guess there was some value in that resulting in so much evidence being on the record, maybe.
There really was. I mean, just as a teaching tool, you know, it showed a lot about the way the criminal justice system works. And it was very thorough. It's not a question of – this wasn't a slipshod investigation by the prosecutor. But it wasn't an aggressive effort to get a police officer convicted. Right. Some people think that's right. Some people think that's wrong. But it was in no way a typical criminal case.
Right. Now, what about the I Can't Breathe case?
Yeah, that one, you know, is different in the sense that the death didn't result from, you know, something as violent as a shooting. But it's clear to me that the police conduct was unsupportable, was unwarranted. You know, yet you can you can point to instances where Mr. Garner was resisting, you know, and wasn't fully compliant and all. So that may have justified an arrest and the use of some force, perhaps. But there were, what, 6-7 cops. He was a big man, obviously. But they never had any doubt but that he was subdued and under control. And when he began complaining that he couldn't breathe, they didn't react to that in any way at all. Now, police will tell you that they hear complaints like that from people they arrest all the time. But when someone is subdued and under control, right, you know, the obligation...
What's the downside of respecting the complaint if they're under control?
Right, exactly. So, you know, it was a pretty clear-cut case of excessive force, I think.
So you think there should have been an indictment in that case?
Yeah, I think there should have been. You know, not so if the officer in the Michael Brown case was guilty of something, it was an intentional homicide. Mm-hmm. In the Garner case, there was no intentional homicide. They weren't trying to kill him. No reasonable interpretation of the evidence would suggest that. But in terms of reckless conduct, it's a little hard to understand how there wasn't an indictment.
And do you think it gets back to the fact that prosecutors are very – I mean, do you think the prosecutor gave it his all?
Well, we don't know. You know, we don't have nearly as much disclosure as to what went on there. So it would just be speculation. But, you know, certainly the local prosecutor didn't proceed with that case in the way that a special prosecutor or someone from the state attorney general's office would have likely proceeded.
What do you mean by that? What would they
In other words, the amount of vigor with which they, you know, attempted to get an indictment, I think would have almost certainly been stronger if the prosecutor didn't have these close ties with the police.
So you think the prosecutor was holding back?
If I had to guess, I have no evidence of this, but if I had to guess, yeah, they
were. It seems like it wouldn't be hard to present the evidence in a way. Remember, you're not trying to get a you don't need to get a conviction.
That's right.
You know, you're just saying, shouldn't this go to court? And you need to persuade a few people of that.
All you need to do is convince the grand jury that there's probable cause to believe that a crime was committed, you know, based on the evidence taken in the light most favorable to the government.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting about these two cases is the role of technology. The reason there was an uproar in the I Can't Breathe case is because it was documented on video. It may be the case that the reason there was an uproar in Ferguson is because it wasn't. In other words, if there had been video, we might well have seen the guy approach the cop, you know, Michael Brown approach, what was it, Darren Wilson or whatever, start punching him or whatever. We don't know. It might be that the you know, the hands up meme would have never gotten around. I mean, certainly, I think the meme that got around right after the shooting turns out to have been oversimplified at best. I think there was the idea, the guy is sitting there, you know, the cop gets out of his car, calmly blows him away. I think it's clear that didn't happen. But the conception of something like that having happened is what got it off the ground. So, you know, have you thought much about how technology, I mean, more and more stuff is documented on video. And there are, of course, these movements now to have police routinely have cameras documenting every arrest they make. Have you thought about this stuff?
Sure. Well, this really got started with videotaping interrogations, you know, in police station interrogations. And at first, the police greatly resisted it for reasons you know, sure, might imagine. But in many jurisdictions today, it's routine and the norm. And it's only recently, with the availability of little cameras spread to police activity out in the street. Interestingly, you know, more and more police departments are favorable towards it because it's just as likely to show that what the police officer did was justified as not. So, yeah, in the Mike Brown, Darren Wilson case, my guess is if there had been a camera there that captured the whole interaction, there might be gray areas. People might see the videotape differently, but it would overwhelmingly point in one direction or another. You know, and similarly with the Staten Island case, although people do argue about how much he was resisting and whether the police were applying too much force, it's really on the margins that there can be any disagreement because you can see what actually happened. So I think it's a big advance for protection of police, protection of citizens, and getting at the truth to have these cameras becoming ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the people on the other side of the thing can use them as well. When your car is stopped, I mean, you could have a little camera that is poised to tape whatever happens if your car is stopped by a cop. It wouldn't be hard.
Right. And then, you know, think about the tape of the gentleman from India who was taken down in the street. I think it was in Florida. He was there visiting family, and there'd been some report of some suspicious person, and the police tried to talk to him. He didn't understand what they were saying. And basically this cop threw him to the ground in a vicious, you know, takedown. And that videotape from the police car led that officer to be fired and is now being prosecuted.
I tell you, this was right, I guess, before the age when everything could be videotaped by passersby. I was driving, I was in a cab in Miami, and Mike Kinsley was with me. We were at the Miami Book Fair, and there was a cop. He was walking a young guy who may have been Latino, but a young guy, maybe 17. He had him by the back of the neck, and the guy wasn't resisting. And he just walked him off the street. He put his leg over so he could trip him. He pushed him down to the ground, and he just started punching him. And it was in plain view. I mean, there were cars everywhere. And, you know, Mike and I looked at each other like, I don't think we're rooting for the cop here, right? It was like, and you know, today, that's like, you know, that would be just asking for the end of your career, right? Just because everyone's got a cell phone.
Yeah, and you know, there's a whole new generation of police leaders that is much more in tune with community relations, not just because technology can show what they're doing, but that's got to be a part of it. I mean, think about the police. You've always been an astute student of human nature. You know, think about the job the police have to do. It's an you and I can't imagine how hard that job is, how much violence and terrible stuff they see, and they feel put upon in all kinds of ways. And without proper scrutiny, it's inevitable that there is going to be abuse along the way. You know, but now, partly because of these scandals, you know, more and more police departments are really trying to do the right thing. I listened to a great report on This American Life the last 2 weeks about race and policing. Mm-hmm. And for example, in some departments, they're giving implicit bias training. Showing, you know about that, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's a subtle psychological test where you respond to these prompts that aren't obviously related to racism, and yet it's kind of detecting your unconscious racial bias. I took one, it turns out I'm biased against white people. That was the finding, which makes sense because there are a lot of white assholes when you think about it.
So it's a really interesting tool, and you know, we all have biases that come through in all kinds of ways. And there are some departments that are training their officers, you know, to just give them a little sort of mental toolkit to not react just because of someone's race or other factors like that. So you know, the good news is that technology and other advances are allowing police departments of good faith to actually have better relations with their communities than they've had in recent years.
So in this case, they give them the test and they say, now, do you understand you have a particular fear of African-Americans or something, or you have a particular bias toward African-Americans?
It's not just that they do the test. They're also trainers that come in and help them kind of interpret the results. So, for example, there's a thing that's tailored for police, you know, that they show these scenarios and ask, you have to quickly decide, are you in danger and do you shoot or not? Uh-huh. And it turns out that the, you know, African-American in a business suit gets shot at way more often than the white kid with guns hanging out of his pocket.
Like holding an AK-47.
Right? Yeah, and things like that. And it's just a question of sensitizing everyone to what our biases are and how they translate into the rapid decision-making that we have to make.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, and I will say, I mean, getting back to the human nature question, I think people can underestimate the extent to which when police overreact in a case involving an African-American, what's going on is fear, is genuine fear with the cop. Now it may be fear grounded in racial bias or something, but it is, I think it's much more often fear than it is, hey, it's a black guy, I want to hurt him because I don't like black people, right?
Yeah, it's generally not that kind of explicit thing. Look, the facts are that violence in the African-American community, the rates of violence are much higher than in white communities. That's shown by victimization surveys and every other tool that's known to criminal justice research. Now, the overwhelming majority of victims of black violence are black victims, of course. Mm-hmm. But you know, for the police working in high violence communities, mm-hmm. they're sensitized to expecting every encounter to potentially be a violent one. So if they're working around, you know, mostly African-American people, most of the violence they're going to see is by African-American people. It takes special training, special self-discipline, special empathy, you know, to be in those situations and be a good human being in your encounters with the vast majority of citizens who are ordinary people who just want to, you know, live their life in peace.
Yeah. No, it's a tough job. I would not be cut out for it.
I can guarantee you that neither you nor I would be any good at it.
I think you'd be better than I would. You played football in high school. Any other thoughts on race and policing? There's the mass incarceration issue we can talk about a little bit before we go. But before we get to that, any other thoughts on Ferguson-related, Ferguson-type things?
No, I think, you know, obviously a lot of the loudest noise about it has died down. But I hope that behind the scenes, there's still a lot of work going on to understand how these things happen and to you know, lower the rhetoric and increase the actual work being done to reduce the likelihood of these situations.
Mm-hmm. I mean, my frustration with the demonstrations, it reminds me of my frustration about the Occupy demonstrations, which is that they didn't have specific concrete goals. I mean, with Occupy, that was the whole point. There was an explicitly, you know, anarchic, in the ideological sense, dimension to the Occupy demonstrations. But in the case of Ferguson, what I was hoping would emerge is what we talked about earlier, which was demand that we change the system by which police misconduct is investigated, which is just obviously fraught with conflict of interest.
Well, that's one. And another is we need to get better data. You know, there isn't a good national source of data on police-involved shootings. Mm-hmm. The police and prosecutors have in many jurisdictions guarded that information too carefully. So we don't know how often police shoot people nationally and how often those are interracial shooting incidents and all kinds of other really important things. So, you know, we're flying in the dark without data that we ought to have.
Okay, let's talk a little about mass incarceration. Now, you argued a case for the Supreme Court, which was about mandatory sentencing?
It involved mandatory minimums back in 1997, but it was a pretty technical case that your viewers wouldn't really be interested in. But the important thing is it was in the era.
Are you just afraid to disclose that you lost?
Oh, I lost. Absolutely, I lost. Yeah. So I will disclose that and still say it's not a case of general interest.
Okay.
Given the nature of what the Supreme Court chooses to decide, it was a statutory interpretation about whether mandatory minimums apply to one category of offenders, et cetera.
But you were on the anti-mandatory minimum side of the argument, right?
That's right. I had worked as a congressional staffer for the House Judiciary Committee in the 80s, and then as a law professor, I did a lot of writing about mandatory minimums and sentencing law, you know, in the era when everyone, including the Democrats, was climbing over each other's backs to be tougher on crime and impose longer sentences on drug offenders, basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is the status? I mean, the kind of over-incarceration issue results largely from the war on drugs. Is that right?
Yeah. We, you know, when you look at our incarceration patterns compared to other advanced democracies where 2-3-10 times higher in incarceration rates, and we are higher in violent crime punishment, but not dramatically so. It's really about drug crimes where we're off the charts, and that's what's fueled in large part, you know, the 500% increase in our prison population from the 80s to today.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what is the, so there's been a movement against this. And I guess that at least partly has to do with mandatory minimums, but not exclusively, right?
Although mostly about mandatory.
It mostly is about mandatory minimums. That is the main reason for the part of the mass incarceration issue that people complain about and are trying to change?
Yeah, yes. Because, you know, without mandatory minimums, judges have discretion. Plea bargaining lets the parties, you know, work things out at a lower level. But the way the mandatory minimums work in federal law and in many states in drug cases, they're quantity-based mandatory minimums. So if you're convicted of a crime with X grams of crack, you have to get a sentence of 5 or 10 or 20 years. Gives the prosecutors enormous power in charging, and it ties the hands of judges. So that really has been the mandatory minimums and the three strikes laws, which is another form of mandatory minimum sentence based on repeat offending.
Right.
Those have been the two main drivers of this.
Right. And as people have noted, there's an obvious racial bias here for various reasons, one of them being that you don't have stop and frisk policies in middle-class suburbs or upper-class suburbs.
Yeah, it's the biggest, by far, the biggest reason for the enormous disparity, racial disparity in prison. Mm-hmm. Is because of the war on drugs for a couple of reasons. You know, drug usage rates across the races are very similar. There isn't a big disparity. But systemically, we punished crack 7, 10, 20 times harsher than powder cocaine. And crack was the drug of choice in inner city communities. That by itself led to massive disparities racially. And then policing practices, stop and frisk, you know, and those kind of things, and where the police do these activities. Mm-hmm. And then discretionary decision making by prosecutors and judges. At each step of the way, there's more sorting of offenders, with minority offenders getting treated more harshly.
Now, there are people who say, well, okay, there is this disparity, but the fact is that locking up a lot of people for drug offenses has kept people off the streets who might have otherwise committed violent crimes. And there are people who argue that this is responsible for a decline in violent crime, right?
Yeah, I think the best evidence is that that has not been demonstrated. And a really good way to do that, prove that, is you can compare cities that had and states that had very severe mandatory penalties and states that didn't.
Mm-hmm.
In both sets of states, the crime rate went down at a comparable level. You know, we've had this massive drop in crime from the early 90s to today.
Mm-hmm.
In my city of Chicago, where there's so much attention about murders and other shootings that go on today, and it's a big problem. But the murder rate here is half of what it was 30 years ago. And in New York, the drop has been even more dramatic than that. And you can make an argument, I'm not comfortable making this argument, but it's a better argument that tough penalties on gun offenses,
mm-hmm,
have had a bigger effect on crime reduction than the really harsh penalty on drug crimes.
Yeah. So there has been this backlash against mass incarceration. Is it starting to take effect, or is the pendulum swinging in the other direction now?
It's definitely swinging in the other direction. A number of states have scaled back their mandatory penalties. A number of other states are considering it, and this is across the parties. Illinois recently elected a Republican governor, and he's establishing a commission to make recommendations about scaling back the use of incarceration. Now, part of this is driven by cost. You know, in many states today, the government spends more on prisons than they do on schools. And nobody thinks that's a recipe for long-term success for society.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also an ideological component. You know, the sort of libertarian thread in the Republican Party, people like Rand Paul, are against too much government, whether it's regulating business or locking people up. So, you know, more than any time since I've been in this field, there's momentum towards more what I believe are reasonable sentencing policies. There's still a lot of resistance. You know, Senator Chuck Grassley, who's the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, recently spoke out vehemently against any rethink of mandatory minimums at the federal level. And, you know, the bottom line is no one ever won an election by reducing criminal penalties.
Right.
And, you know, that's the problem.
Yeah.
All the incentives politically point towards being tougher.
But we do seem to be moving in what you consider the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's only taken 30 years, but the movement is definitely in that direction. And look, you know, we have to remember that the communities that are most at need in our society, most poor people, you know, worst schools, they suffer from the most crime too. Mm-hmm. But they also suffer from large swaths of their population being sent off to prison, disrupting the social fabric of the community. It's just a terrible situation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, thank you, David. This has been very illuminating. We'll have to have you back to discuss criminal justice issues again.
Thanks, Bob. Getting on Blogging Heads has always been on my bucket list, so I'm happy to get to cross that one
off. It's the highest aspiration of so many Americans, David, and you're one of the few who's been chosen. Congratulations on that.
I appreciate it, Bob.
Okay, good luck with the investigation. It's important.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye. All right.